Okay. Page 88, Chapter 4, Combating Pride. Be in the battle and fight well. Yoranda, I think that if I change my obedience and stop chanting and making icons, I will then stop being proud and constantly making mistakes. There's something that she can do. She's good at chanting. It's her obedience, but it leads to pride. She has a problem with the pride and the pride of being pleased with the quality of her icons. So she's thinking maybe it might be better if she stopped doing those things that are making her proud. But is it the doing of them that's making her proud? Is there something else? And Saint Paisios replies to her, in reality, you want to leave these obediences so your ego is not bruised. We're fulfilling these things that we have a talent for. Periodically, our ego is bruised. Why would that be, do you think? Bruised. There's an expression about great singers, female singers, divas. A diva is an operatic singer who is just one of the absolute best. But if you're one of the absolute best and somebody criticizes you, or if you make a mistake, then your ego is bruised. And so oftentimes it's the people who have talents, and in the exercise of those talents, they find that their ego gets beat up because, well, nobody's perfect all the time. And there's things that God does with us in order to keep us from being prideful. Elder Paisios will get to those later on. Yoranda, when I am doing some work and I see that it makes me prideful, isn't it better that I not do it? There's pride in this already. Because the pride is that I'm so good at this, I can't help but being proud, And I'm reminded again of my first choir director, saying that, and I was concerned. I told him that I was, at least I was not proud. And he said, well, you don't have anything to be proud of. You're just starting. You don't know anything. You're not good at anything. You read your sermons and you serve badly. So in order to have a problem with pride, you have to be good at something. So being humble because you can't do anything, right? What?
That's not true.
What's not true?
That you have to be good at something to have a problem with pride?
No, I don't think it's true either, but it's what he told me. Because as a matter of fact, he was very good at being a choir director and very good at liturgical music and was famous. He had done great work as far as bringing music from Slavonic into English, breaking it up so that it could be sung in English, and he was famous for that. He was very well known. So he figured his problem was that he had to struggle with pride because he was so good at what he did, whereas I have no problem. I had no problem as somebody who'd just been ordained a priest last month because I was bad at everything, so it's easy for me to be humble. Well, actually, that's not so. That comes up later. There are people who have no talents and yet have great pride and are some of the strongest critics of those who are able to do things, as a matter of fact. They criticize them out of their own pride, which they have no objective justification for, but pride doesn't depend, as Sharon is saying, on what you can do. Okay, so Elder Paisios says, no, you can't just withdraw from the work that you're given the obedience to do, probably because they have the talent to do it. They give you the obedience to do it, and it becomes your spiritual struggle to do it humbly. If they tell you to do some task, you should go and do it, but be careful not to fall. Top of 89, second sentence. Try to do it well and humbly. To not do anything in order to avoid becoming prideful makes things worse. The goal is to remain in the battle and to make sure you fight well. otherwise you become useless. So you're in the battle, you're doing the things that you're assigned to do, and you fight the pride when it comes. Strive to do it well and humbly. Difficult. Spiritual challenge. Pride can be crushed with the help of others. Yolanda, I get upset when the sisters make some sort of comment about me. Ooh, bruising the ego, right? Accept criticism with humility. This is how one's soul becomes clean. Since it is difficult for one to discern his prideful mindset on his own, accept others as if they were doctors and take all the medicine they give to be delivered from that passion. Good people, going down a couple lines, the good people counsel those that are sick, while evil people censure them with evilness and passion, and they often prove to be better doctors than the first. Why is that?
It says something about the scalpel.
They won't spare your ego.
Yes.
There's that wonderful prayer for enemies where what's being prayed for is thanking God for the enemies that give us more spiritual advantage than anyone because they don't take any mercy on us. Someone who loves us is liable to be more merciful, but enemies don't. You know, we all see each other's shortcomings. Most of the time we don't tell other people their shortcomings. We shouldn't anyway. We should be more concerned with our own. But people who make themselves enemies to others don't hold back. They say all these hurtful things, and that's the scalpel. If we respond to them in that way, not that they're doing good by doing what they're doing. No, what they're doing they ought not to be doing. But if we respond not by defending ourselves and with our hurt egos and bruised egos and then respond in kind, but instead of doing that, realize that here is some spiritual criticism that if we humbly accept it, it may do us a great deal of good. Last paragraph. It is better to say, I am most competent, but I have no humility. Instead, you try to justify yourself when you are censured for your error. This is what we almost always do. Last word on the page. The person who justifies himself when people reprove him is constantly closing the door to humility. The person who takes responsibility for his mistake is humbled and bathed by the grace of God. Yolanda, I think that I am not trying to prove that I am right. This is a defense that I hear on a regular basis. And people, when they make this defense, think they are being humble. They think that they are turning the point of criticism, the actually spiritual guidance that's been offered to them, and they're defending themselves. Yolanda, I think I am not trying to prove that I am right, but rather that I am trying to explain that it is a matter of misunderstanding. You know, that's what people say. Elder Paisios says, I have noticed that you have a hidden pride that expresses itself in justification, and often this is voiced in the gentlest of words because it's intended to sound humble. You should try not to justify yourself. Instead, saying, Evlogison, forgive me with sincere repentance. Pride is severed when we say, forgive me, as our response. Last three full lines in the next paragraph. Why is it that some people have such a hard time saying, Evlogison, forgive me? Pride does not allow a person to say Evlogison. So we just can't get it out of our mouth. Instead, we try to gently instruct the person who is giving us some kind of spiritual criticism by explaining, oh, no, you have it all wrong. Let me explain that it isn't like that at all. I really was not prideful. And so we justify ourselves. In this case, we're justifying our sense that we're not prideful, but we were wronged. That's what we do. The spiritual splitting of the atom. We can stop there and talk about that. See if this makes sense in terms of your own experience. You know, it's funny, if we're in a class for something that we're good at, whether it's art or poetry or music or whatever it is, we want to have the class and we want to have criticism. We say, I need criticism in order to get better. We know that. But once we're being instructed by someone who is more advanced than we are, some instructor who's been trained as a teacher, of people who make an effort, it might be not the arts, it might be some kind of craftsman, and to work with a craftsman who is a master craftsman. And the master craftsman will start where we are and take our skill and our ability for granted and look for those places where he can be of help to us. And that's going to always take the form of pointing out to us where we can start and get better. But our natural response, unless we really are concerned about the excellence of our work, more than we're concerned about our ego, our natural response is going to be to explain and to justify why we're doing it the way we are. And until we can be humble and not do that, we never take the point of criticism that is intended to lift us up beyond where we are as far as our ability to do things at a certain level. So it applies to craftsmanship, it applies to the arts, and it applies to spiritual life also. You know, when we hear Elder Paisios give us spiritual advice, sometimes we might want to defend ourselves. What do you think? Here we are, we're the same four of us as last week. Did you get to borrow your dad's book?
I think he's here now.
Is he?
Oh, yeah. You see the headlight. Saw the car roll in.
Okay. But did you get to borrow the book?
Not yet.
Not yet. You be sure to ask him.
To me, yeah. I don't know, the pridefulness and vainglory to me are very close together. Because there's a lot of times I have so much pride, I don't want anybody to be able to criticize me, so it'll keep me from attempting to do something because I might get criticism because I know I'm not really good at it or something. You know, like you don't want to.
Yeah. Well, do you have, at your pottery class, do you have any kind of difficulty there of this kind? Or are you just anxious to know a technique that is going to enable you to do things that you couldn't do before?
No, usually I don't have this kind of problem.
That's it. Whenever we're more concerned with the work, I think, than we are with ourselves. And that's why I think craftsmanship can be a good example for us. But you know, that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about having this super critical husband, because I am a critical person.
No.
No, not me.
But I think it's, you know, a lot of times that it, and that's more of a vainglory than it is.
I know what you mean. It's like vainglory is like an active effort to maintain your pride somehow.
Yeah.
Maybe. I've never heard it put like that, but you know, that may be. Is it raining again?
It is. Off and on. It keeps spitting at us. Forgive me for being late.
Did you, want to say anything
else? No, I think that's about it.
Okay, we are on page 90.
Page 90.
First new topic, the spiritual splitting of the atom. As you know, the atom is from ancient Greek times. The atom was more so actually than in modern physics. The atom means the smallest, part of something. You know. Now we have theories of atomic physics, and we know that atoms have parts, and they have a nucleus, and they have electrons going around them, and they have protons and neutrons, and there's a lot of other stuff in there too.
Quarks,
and it's become pretty complicated. But the idea of an atom is that it is the smallest possible unit. And there are people, I think it's a common assumption in our society today, that the individual, each individual is an independent humanity all by themselves. We don't need other people to be human. I am a human being, even without. If I were the last person on Earth, I would still be as fully human as I am in a world where I'm tempted to act like I'm the only human being on Earth, and other people are just kind of, you know, in my parade, you know, or in my play. They're character actors or extras, you know, and I'm the star. Because we can all be like that. We're all the center. You know, there's philosophies like that. They say that the truth is that each one of us is the center. You know, oh, very mysterious. It sounds very mystical. Well, it's not true. You know, that's not the way things are. That is an egoistical attitude. The reality is quite different. Yolanda, how can I get rid of the exaggerated opinion I have of myself? Look within yourself. Come to know your own self. You will see so much ugliness that you will be repulsed. This is self-knowledge. We've heard this before in other texts that we've read. Top of 91. If a person does not come to know himself in order to be humbled naturally, then for him humility cannot become a state of being that will secure divine grace within himself. Then the devil becomes capable of destroying all the years of his life, one year after another, living the same way. Even if God should give him the many years of Methuselah, 969 years. What is it? Playing that game of foolish nonsense for 900 years, wherein the devil will start off by giving him the prideful thought that he is someone significant, followed by the humble thought that he is insignificant. Remember that, up and down and up and down. And this false humility that you get when you're down because you're not doing well, how do you get out of that? Well, by building yourself up. And you know, so it's pride, false humility, pride, false humility. Each one of those crashes into false humility is only a spur to be, you know, to be become more devoted to building up your pride again.
Is this, he's telling you to know yourself.
Yeah.
Well, they tell you, philosophy tells you to know yourself too.
Right, yeah. Socrates.
Socrates, yeah. So. That seems quite different to me than the Elder Pace.
Well, Socrates' idea was that what he knew about himself was that he was ignorant. So maybe not completely different.
Maybe not, okay.
When,
I just don't know enough about philosophy.
Well, I don't know about philosophy. I mean, if that was Socrates said that. Socrates' student was Plato. He wrote a lot. Socrates didn't write anything. He just had conversations and discussions. Deciding where Socrates ends and Plato begins, people have been trying to figure that out for the 4th century B.C.
Is Plato considered a martyr?
No.
Some people would
consider Socrates a martyr, but not a Christian martyr.
I read something in one of the
Plato
stories about the martyr Plato, his brother.
Oh, that's another Plato.
It's a different Plato.
Yeah, okay. Plato was a name that others took.
Okay.
You know, later on. So there is a Saint Plato, but it's not Socrates' student who taught Aristotle. Different Plato.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. I didn't think so. Yeah. But I just thought I'd ask.
But Socrates, well, he's a complex figure like anybody else. But he did. His understanding was the unique knowledge that he had was that he did not understand anything. And he believed in engaging in dialogue with others so that maybe he could become more understanding. But what he found out was that nobody else knew anything either. So he tried to build up an understanding of things. Bertrand Russell, now you're really tempting me into philosophy, but Bertrand Russell said that we should rejoice just as much when we find out that something is wrong as we do when we find out that something is right, because we have knowledge. We know that something that we had thought before was incorrect, and this is knowledge. So Socrates' knowledge is one by one, all of the false idols of the ancient Greeks in Athens were turned over, you know, by Socrates. That's why he was so disliked by the authorities. He was like the universal solvent. There wasn't anything that he couldn't cut right through and point the, and his idea was, let's get together and realize that this and that and the other thing is not true. Maybe we can go higher. So if we apply that to knowledge of oneself, Christianity, when Christianity comes, now you're into a depth of self-evaluation and a standard according to the revelation of Christ of our humanity that goes beyond Socrates.
I think, based on what you're saying, Matushka, you know, the idea that it's foreign that to know yourself from Father Paisios or Saint Paisios. I think, you know, knowing a false version of ourselves is what most of us, you know. We become friends with this, this our ego, which is this idol we've made of ourselves that, you know, that I like to polish and keep, you know. And I'm very upset if somebody does something to say something against that. And, you know, if I find myself very defensive, then I know they're not really, it's not that I'm upset about something they said about me, but something they said about my idol I'm making, if I can keep that in mind, you know. But to really know ourselves, that we have to do that to be able to repent properly, I think, maybe.
Definitely.
From St. Paisios.
And also Elder Simeon, Craigiopolis. Same message, know thyself. The way we think of it today is based on a conviction that each one of us is all by ourselves, unique and of ultimate value. Know yourself, be true to yourself, all of that. But all of that is just only goes back a few hundred years. It doesn't go back to, you can't blame Socrates for it. It doesn't go back even to the Middle Ages. But once we're positive that each individual, me to start with, because I mean you can take care of yourself. I'll think of myself and know thyself. Know your abilities, know your capacities, have confidence, that sort of thing. These things that I am knowing about myself that are so wonderful are quite different from the idea of what happens when you know yourself as you actually are that we find in Elder Simeon or Saint
Paisios.
So yeah, it's a different understanding of self-knowledge, but it's more different from a humanistic and modern idea of the self and the importance of the self than it is different from Socrates. Not to make Socrates out to be a Christian saint, because he's not. He's just Socrates. And he would agree with that, which is kind of nice. Okay, the devil gives you the prideful thought that you're significant, followed by the humble thought that you're insignificant. And when we have that, we think we're being really humble. We're not. In this way, the devil scores a point. And then the person scores a point back and forth. And so it goes forever. I notice, Yolanda, that all the sisters have surpassed me in virtue, even the younger ones. Since you have not humbled yourself, you have been humbled by others. Do you know what they do when they want to launch a rocket into outer space? They start counting backwards. 10, 9, 8, 7, 1, 0. As soon as they come to zero, the rocket takes off. Come down to zero, and you will also be launched and go very far. You get the point? Middle of the next little paragraph. The spiritual splitting of your own atom, your own self, will take place when you get down to zero. Like the splitting of the atom in physics, there is something that can only happen by the splitting of that atom. Last two sentences. When the spiritual splitting of your atimo, your own self, takes place, spiritual power will be released and you will be launched into outer space. This is the only way to enter the spiritual orbit. Otherwise, you remain in the worldly orbit. What do you think of his comparison?
What I was thinking about it before is that seems like the time that I have become the most humble are times when I find myself falling into sin again. I'm like, oh, and I thought, and why am I humble? Because I didn't think I could fall into that sin again. Well, or to a different, worse sin even. And I was thinking, if there's a better way, how can we humble ourselves in a way that instead of finding out, oh, I'm weaker than I thought I was, rather than just, you know, this poor, I understand this nun's feeling.
Listen, there's something that you just said that links up perfectly with things that we talked about last week.
Okay.
When Elder Paresios was describing physical law, like you throw something up into the air, the higher you throw it, the more force it comes back down with and hits the ground. It's inevitable. It's inescapable. But he says there is a spiritual law where that doesn't have to happen. He says it's possible for us when our ego is taking off, instead of us peaking and crashing down to earth again, which is going to happen just as it would if we were at the mercy of the laws of necessity. You know, what comes up must go down. You know, pride, fall. There is a way out of that, according to the spiritual law, if on the way up we recognize that we are increasing in pride and we repent on the way up before we get to the top, and it's inevitable that we'll fall, then God will let us down gently. That's how he describes the spiritual law.
A humility parachute sort of thing.
Pretty much. Well, it's a parachute. We're still dependent on natural, you know, resistance of the parachute and all that. So God is the parachute, you know, and he intervenes, you know. But he intervenes on the basis of our sudden recognition. You know, look at this disgusting thing. In other words, we don't get to be disgusted with ourselves after it's all over and we've sinned. But if we are disgusted with ourselves on the way up as pride increases, then we never get up to the peak. Therefore, we never inevitably crash. So if we keep going up to the peak and then crashing, that's not really true humility. We can repent because we've crashed. But the humility, real humility, is the humility that we have. We are free to embrace on the way up before we get to the top. Then God will let us down gently.
Yeah.
Only if we don't, you know, say, hey, I'm really charging up there now. Let's go all the way up. You are going to come down.
To me, this happens most when I try to make a spiritual effort. And I'm making a spiritual effort, and I may even have some, a little bit of success, or feel like I'm having a little bit of success, and then almost immediately after I feel like I have some little bit of success, I start being prideful, and instead of realizing, you know, that it's God that's giving me the success and not my effort, you know? So I begin to have pride in my effort, and then the next thing I know, then I've committed a sin that's worse than, you know, and I have seemed like I have no control over it, you know, then it's worse than the good that I had thought I had achieved.
I wish I didn't understand what you were talking about, but I do.
Yeah.
I used to have this dream, and this maybe is, you know, I think about it, it's something maybe I was, God, there's a song in the Color Purple, maybe God's trying to tell you something. When I was a kid, I used to have this dream, I would be running and I would jump up, I could jump really high, and I'd jump higher. And then I'd wake up because I jumped so high, I realized when I come back down, it's going to hurt. And I would wake up. And it's the same thing. I mean, it's a similar thing, but it reminds me of what you were saying. You know,
yeah.
We go higher, and our pride gets higher, and I realize, oh, I'm going to break my legs if I come down from this height. And realize I don't have a way to go down slower. I can jump high, but now I'm so high that I'm going to. And I don't know why I had the dream, but maybe God was trying to tell me something.
or at least there's a lesson that could be learned there. You jump too high, you're going to come back down hard.
It's funny.
Which feeds back to the beginning of this chapter, where the one nun decided that she had a strategy, and her strategy was she was not going to do those things that made her pride fall. And, you know, the Elder Paisia says,
no,
you have to engage in the battle. You can't just, because it is a battle. It's a battle to do what you're talking about.
Do the good works that you're trying to accomplish, but...
humbly. Instead of being fed, instead of letting your ego feed on them.
I know the enemy, one of the things that's been a struggle, a long time ago, I used to try to get family prayers going in the morning, get family prayers given. Well, then I'd be mad and finally get everybody there and have a little king comfort of the spirit. You know, and what am I doing? At that time, we were going up to Greenville, and I said, Father Mark, is this what I'm doing? Sherry said, well, maybe we shouldn't even do them. And that was a reasonable thought. I said, well, you know. He said, no, continue to do them, but don't be angry. So it's the same thing. I think it's the same advice that St. Paisios is giving. It's easier to have the temptation to quit. So.
Yeah. Middle of just before the middle of the first full paragraph in 192. When one knows his own self, then the splitting of his otomo takes place automatically. So the splitting of the otomo means that this ego is cut in half and it's not functional all of a sudden, allowing him to move into the spiritual orbit beyond the attraction of Earth's gravity, beyond the attractions of this world. While living on earth, one can live without being attracted by sin and generally by the desires of the world. When pride remains, jumping down a couple of lines, the splitting of his own atimo has not yet taken place. Do you understand? In other words, it all comes back to humility. Exactly. The person who has pride has not yet come to know his true self. Pride is dispelled when one knows his own self. There can be no humility without this recognition. Know thyself. Yolanda, what happens if there is recognition but no humility? In other words, we know exactly what's going on inside of us, but we maintain pride. There is no good disposition. There is no philotimo, there it is, philotimo. There is no philotimo without good disposition, recognition of how we actually are, and humility. Page 93, topic high position and humble disposition. Yolanda, is there pride in me? Well, yes, there is a little pride. At least we should have normal pride as much as the law permits, the spiritual law. That would mean that we would go up to a certain point and then be humble. It's not that we don't go up, you know. We do the things that we can do that are significant and important, but we cut ourselves off when it comes to feeding on them spiritually in a prideful kind of way. That's what the law doesn't permit. Let me explain. If one has certain gifts, knowledge, experience, so forth, then he is somewhat justified by those extenuating circumstances that make it completely reasonable to have some sense of the value of what we're able to do. Not even that pride is a good thing. In other words, it will not spiritually advance us. That's the standard. What is good and what isn't? Will it advance us or won't it? Okay, not even that pride is a good thing. But it is justifiable to a degree. But one who has no such gifts or knowledge cannot be justified in being prideful. He must be humble. If such a person is prideful, maybe that's what my choir director was trying to tell me. You have no choice, you have to be humble. He didn't seem to think it was a good thing, though.
Who?
My first choir director. Were you here when I was talking about it?
No, I missed that.
Okay. It was something that I struggled with when I first came out of seminary. What have I got to be proud about? Well, hey, I've been to St. Vladimir's Seminary. Father Alexander Schmemann was the first reader on my dissertation. I did pretty well. I got a, what did I forget what it's called, some kind of notable recognition for my dissertation. So I could be prideful about all those things, and especially with the idea that many of us had in those days that the only thing that was needed in parishes, you know, where people were not living a spiritual life and at these parishes, you know, all they really needed was education. And hey, I had that. So I could be proud of that. So even though I didn't know what I was doing pastorally, I didn't have a clue, you know, even though I didn't know what I was doing as far as anything that fell outside of the narrow range of my abilities, I could be proud of those abilities and not recognize what an ignoramus I was, you know, with complete zero level of any experience. I mean, I should have realized, because they told us, we want to know, well, how you go about being a priest? The people will teach you. Well, how will the people teach you? They will teach you by engaging you in exactly this kind of spiritual conflict that you had best deal with Philotimo and spiritual nobility, because if you don't, you're going to become a horrible, horrible, bad influence in every parish. So you have to, you know, engage in this spiritual effort, this spiritual struggle. And over the course of 30 years, you know, then you feel like, hey, I wish I was, and I knew this. I mean, I never wanted to be a new priest. And I'd tell Mr. Kopostansky, the choir director, who was so well known, I wish I had been a priest for 30 years. You know, I've done, I don't like being this pitiful. But after 30 years, you feel like, how do you feel? Basically, I'm ready to start. And you know, the possibility of arrogance is still there, because it's not based on anything that you deserve to be prideful about. Arrogance never is, you know. Mm-hmm. So you still fall into arrogance, spiritually, emotionally, but you know the reality of things. So even the pride that we could have in whatever ability we have is not a good thing, but it's understandable to a degree. As long as it doesn't bring you all the way up to the peak, and then you have the crash. So you need to recognize when you start to take off, you know, stay in the air. Don't fly all the way up to the stratosphere where you can't breathe. But one who has no such gifts or knowledge cannot be justified in being prideful. He must be humble. If such a person is prideful, which I could easily have been, and I'm sure I was to a certain degree, you know, that first 6 months to a, you know, year or longer when I was first a priest. If such a person is prideful, then he is entirely out of line. You see, and he gives an example about nursing. There might be a nurse who may have a prideful thought simply for having given an injection of penicillin to a patient and seeing the patient's fever drop, whereas the man who discovered penicillin, Fleming, and helped so many people, was a humble man. He traveled to America at one point, and the people were applauding him. But because he was humble, he was applauding too. But then he wondered, he asked, what is going on? Who are we applauding? Him, but he said, this is strange. Who are we applauding? We are applauding you, he was told. He was totally taken aback, for he was not even aware that he was the center of attention. Hadn't thought he had ever done anything so great. The man who discovered penicillin did not allow himself to become prideful. To do the work, you ascend. There's a kind of self-confidence that is necessary just in order to do the work. But it's a humble self-confidence, I think. It focuses on the work. The man who discovered penicillin did not allow himself to become prideful. It stops your work anyway at a certain level. There's a point beyond which you're not going to be able to go without humility in a lot of endeavors, it seems to me. Well, here's a nurse who gave an injection of penicillin, became very prideful. This is why St. Basil the Great says, it is most important for a man to have a high position and a humble disposition. For a man. It just says, it doesn't say amen. It is most important for a man to have a high position and a humble disposition. And I think it's a good reason for Basil the Great saying, it is most important for man to have a high position and a humble disposition for man. This is the nature of our humanity, because we do have a high calling. Is this what we have? Instead of the necessity for pride in ourselves and our abilities, we have a high calling as human beings, you know. So we have a high position, but a humble disposition about that calling. Otherwise, we won't be able to fulfill that calling. This is of great value and is rewarded by God. What do you think?
So what you mean by man's high calling is the fact that man is like the...
We are created to be like God.
Yeah.
Which requires absolute humility.
Yeah. Okay.
Because God is humble.
And as, but as created
beings,
we are at the
pinnacle
of, yeah.
Well, we're better than animals.
Well, yes, as far as being better than the nature, we are the ones that are called to bring nature and the knowledge to the knowledge of God. I mean, we have knowledge of God.
We have the potential to know God.
Yeah.
We could also have the potential to live like animals.
Yeah.
In fact, we've talked before about how people these days, when they want to find out what it means to be a human being, they look at animals, which is odd, but that's what we do. Strange.
We are the only creature which our Creator has become one of.
Yes.
Entered into our humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I have... When I was young, I grew up learning that anybody who was successful at any level was just prideful, and that it should be eschewed. A certain kind of snobbery among poor people. That people who have anything, well, they're just, you know, they're bad people, basically. What I found was the more successful people that I met. And I don't mean like in sports or something like that, something where people just skyrocketed, but people have worked, and then well, they were the more humble people that I met, the more humble, kinder, better spoken, more humble people. And that there seems to be a relationship, you know, this doesn't even have to enter into the spiritual realm as we are, but I don't know if you can really separate us from that, but you know, if we were to say it this way, those who take a humble position will find themselves in a higher position. It might be another way to say it. And, I mean, there's something in the scripture like that. We humble ourselves and God will exalt us. If we don't, we'll be humbled, I suppose, like we experience.
Trouble is that God will exalt us, but he doesn't necessarily exalt us.
In the way we like to be exalted.
Yeah, in the way that people would think of as exaltation.
May exalt us in the same way that he ascended and that to the cross.
Yeah.
Glorification, give me the glory that I had before the world was, and he says that before going to his crucifixion, because his glory is that he does what he does on the cross. So, it depends. Aldo Paresios discusses something that I think speaks to the point that you've made, but it depends.
On our motives, Stephen?
No. We'll have to look at it.
Okay.
Well, one of the things that's related to what you've said, though, is I think is way back at the beginning of the book, the first distinction that's made is between external pride and internal pride. External pride is pride that is visible to others in our action. Internal pride is pride that only we could be aware of ourselves. No one else is in a position to see it. So how would we know if a person who is very successful is humble? In their actions, they may be humble.
Well,
but internally,
The stuff I can see, I suppose. Just
yeah. So is that the? It's a matter, which is why it comes down to self-knowledge.
Right.
That it's something that, as Christians, that's what each one of us is supposed to be dealing with, that and respect of persons based on their outward capacities, abilities, success, you know, and seeming humility is not what the spiritual life is about, because the Christian spiritual life is not about comparing ourselves to other people in the first place. It's about knowing yourself. And so the people that you might want to say, well, he's a hard worker, he's a humble person, you don't know that.
Know what's in their hearts, right? You can't see people.
That's something that each person has to deal with. That's our understanding of things.
Sometimes, though, we can see pride, very obviously.
I mean, that's true.
Very obviously.
It becomes external. And again, the earlier chapters, there's a point where Elder Parisios is talking about how ridiculous a person who acts pridefully is to everyone. Even children see it, and they ridicule such a person. So, if we're sufficiently aware about how we appear to others, which is one of those categories, one of those types of concern that Elder Simeon talks about, the concern for how we appear to others, we could devote a lot of effort to how we appear to others. And if we're good at it, you know, some people don't care. You know, some people don't care. You know, and they make it almost a fetish of being incredibly prideful and just parading their pridefulness. And you know, Elder Paisios talked earlier about that sort of thing. So let's get to where he talks about things that I think are related to in a positive way, not just simply condemning people as on a superficial, resentful basis. I'm a mean-spirited and resentful poor person who says, oh, these people who are wealthy, they're all awful people. It's because that kind of a poor person is obviously not humble and wants to be like those he condemns. That's part of it. The values are materialistic and not spiritually humble in any kind of way. So that's the way they would evaluate other people. And as a group, this group of people who have been successful. So Elder Paisios has started something here with pointing out that the person who discovered penicillin was humble to the point that he'd even realized people were applauding him. These days, I'm not sure when people, now it's become the, you know, I remember when this was just never done. I mean, you at least acted humbly when people applauded you. You did this business of applauding yourself. I mean, the first time I saw it, I thought, boy, and only foreign people did it. Americans didn't do it because it just wasn't something that was done. But now everybody does it. And my suspicion is that these days, when someone comes out and applauds, I think they assume that all of the people there, including themselves, are applauding them. And they are applauding themselves too, maybe not others. That's my suspicion. But you know, and things have changed over the decades, because there was a point at which nobody ever did that. It was just socially unacceptable. So social acceptability and acting in a way that is humble, I don't think that's not what we're involved with here, that's for sure. And we can only deal with it individually, each one of us ourselves. So the prideful nurse, she gives a shot, person gets better, boy, what I did. And she's, I mean, yes, she gave the shot, she didn't hit the wrong place and, I don't know, open up a vein, the person didn't bleed to death, that's true, she was competent, but penicillin was discovered by somebody else. It was a gift that was given, just like God gives us gifts, and we shouldn't applaud ourselves for the gifts that he gave us.
Yeah, there's almost nothing we can make that we can really take a lot of pride in.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I don't want to get off on a thing, but okay. Top of page 94. I often see humility in high-ranking officials and pride in simple policemen. Again, contrast. And others with great wealth, with high positions, with extraordinary gifts and talents have such humility, see, acknowledges what Jimmy's talking about, such simplicity. They feel as though, now we're talking about what's going on inside the person though, they feel as though they possess nothing. High-ranking military officers do not wear their uniforms in order to avoid recognition and honors. We'll jump down to the last, second-to-last paragraph line in this section. Yaronda, when one has a humble position and is prideful, does it indicate that he is a fool? Yes, it does. But not only once, but many times over. Don't claim as your own what God has given you. Yaronda, I feel prideful for both the physical capabilities and the spiritual gifts, which I think are my own. Why should you feel prideful? Did you make heaven and earth? God created everything, gave us these gifts, distributed them as he has done. Be careful, don't claim as your own what God has given you. Top of 95. Tell yourself, because I was weak, God has given me some gifts. Otherwise, I would have worried and been wretched. What I have to do now is utilize these gifts towards spiritual enrichment. The argument that success will make you humble, I think, is not a good argument. There's a problem with that. Now, the possibility of being humble, in spite of the fact that we're successful, definitely, no question about it. And he will get into this, how you go about using the gifts that you've been given towards spiritual enrichment. Glory be to you, my Lord. Thank you for taking pity on me and helping me. All the gifts you have received, are they really yours? What hast thou that thou did not receive? Cleverness is needed here. The mind must work and understand that all gifts are from God. If the grace of God abandons us for just a little bit, we will be capable of doing nothing. Down 1, 2, 3, 4 lines. For example, God gives one a little extra brain power, making him capable of running a big business and therefore living comfortably. Should he be prideful for having achieved this? No, for if God were to abandon him for even a little while, he might become bankrupt and go to prison. But if we are proud of the fact that we know how to keep out of bankruptcy and prison, we are not giving glory to God for the gifts that we've been given. In any case, he who has talents but lacks humility and troubles his neighbor with his provocative behavior compels Christ to take the small screwdriver and loosen his screws a bit in order to humble him against his will. So, you have pride in being a, what does they call it, self-made man. Your screws are going to be a little loose. I think for certain. And God is the one that loosened the screws.
There was a king in the Old Testament. I forgot which one it was, but one of the kings of, was it Judah? He was made to be like a beast of the field and eat grass for a year.
I seem to remember that.
He loosened his screws all the way up.
Pride.
He turned him into a cow.
A human being who eats grass.
That idea that we are competent, we have pride in our abilities and stuff, that reminds me of Father Mike Oleska's little story about how he went to the people were out. He was with his friends. They were out hunting for elk. Is it elk? And they had gone a long way, and they were on the river on a boat, right? And they were going up the river on the boat. I don't know if you were there. Maybe you heard that. And
the elk sort of presented itself.
And the elks were up on the cliff, up there, and surely. Said we were making lots of noise and everything, and they knew that we were there. But then they turned around and they were going back, and lo and behold, the elks were down there where they could be shot, and they had enough meat for the season, and so the Eskimos have this idea that they're not just being prideful about their ability to hunt and to get enough food for everybody, but they realize that it's not just them, but it's God or nature or whatever that provides for them. it's that they couldn't do it without the sacrifice.
The animal, I think what I understood what he was saying, actually sacrificed themselves to
right.
help these poor humans that don't have, they don't, how are they going to make? They don't have any fur.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to die. I think all of us were there for that. I think
yeah.
we were all there.
Yeah.
Except for, I don't mind that.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, but it's...
They're ridiculous creatures. They'll never make it.
So their society has the idea that, yeah, that it's not anything that's inherent in human being that makes them able to continue, but it's what has been provided for them by the rest of nature.
Well, even what's inherent in human being has been given to us.
Father yeah. Michael, is that his name?
Father Michael, yeah.
Michael Olesko.
I mean, it's not a Christian, necessarily a Christian idea, but it's a almost like a
There's a Christian sense to it.
Christian sense
yeah.
to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His last name is Olesko, and he lives in Alaska.
Alexa.
Alexa.
Oh. Alexa. That makes it even harder. Alexa from Alaska. Alexa.
I think you could apply some, the same sense to life in the modern world. Well, the medieval expression was fortune empress of the world. There are some people who believe in fortune, and ironically, they're the same people who take credit for done better, you know, in this world that is not ruled by God, but we're not given gifts, or we're not given, I wasn't given anything, you know, I came here with nothing, and I made this incredible fortune, you know, and I just kind of you kind of play according to the rules of the natural world. We talked about this last week, and then they attribute their success entirely to themselves. Elder Paisio says that, you know, God will let people go like this for their entire lives sometimes, and they can die and never be humbled until after they die, and then
that's not what you want.
They're finished. They're finished. They never woke up. They were positive to their last breath that they were on top of things, and all the rest are fools. They're all fools. They're no God. I deserve all this. I've been, you know. But not everyone's like that. Elder Paisios would say that such a person, his brains are loose.
Well, it's such a mercy that God would allow us to fall in a way that prevents us from dying in our arrogance, dying in our pride. That would be such a,
It's compared to a caring father who will discipline a son or a daughter that he loves, but a father who doesn't care won't. You know, of course now, and you could even apply this to the example that we just looked at, what about those people who never get disciplined, who are able to go to their deathbed thinking that they had it all their way? God never intervened. That's because they had cut off every relationship, every possible relationship to God. Their pride made him totally invisible to them. They say, well, there's no God, and I'm doing fine. So God has taken his affection away from you. You've cut off your relationship with God as a father, and he's not disciplining you. He's just letting you enough rope to hang yourself. But those that God cares about, he gives them difficulties.
He whom the Lord loves, he chastens.
Right. Exactly. Okay. It's 5:30. We're at the top of 96, and we're going to talk next about great orators with the screws loose.
Have a care, Rabadash. Jesuits at the door. Remember Rabadash?
Rabadash.
He was the prince, the Kellermine prince, from in the Horse and His Boy, and he had come to bring destruction upon. It was Archenland. I'm not sure how it's like Archenland.
Something like that.
Yeah, he was there, and he got caught, and. His dad had said, well, you can go over there, but I'm not. He said, if they catch you, you didn't come with my blessing, and you need to know I'm not coming to get you. Well, he was caught, and he was standing there, and Aslan shows up. They were trying to decide what to do. They were going to send him back, and he was still rolling his eyes and trying to be very fearful. But they weren't afraid of him because they were free men. He was used to rolling his eyes at slaves, and they would, of course, be afraid because he had the power to cut their heads off. These people weren't afraid of him, and he was under their... He was a prisoner of theirs anyway. And he was making threats, and then Aslan showed up. Well, he knew who Aslan was, but he spoke high, well, just wait till Tash gets older. And Aslan just spoke quietly to him, be careful. But, you know, you have still a chance to repent. And then he starts growing, and he loosened a few screws. Like he grew donkey ears, and he was braying, and he had to go all the way back to the capital city of the Calamians. And if he ever went more than 20 miles away or some, he would turn back into a donkey, and he would never. So he stayed there. He was a very peaceful king when he finally became the king. And his father didn't live forever. I think C.S. Lewis makes a point. His father didn't live forever, even though everybody said, may you live forever. He eventually became the king, and he was a very peaceful king, because he didn't want to come out fighting with him. He couldn't leave, couldn't go very far.